that home museum routine like a book. Phoebe went to the same school I went to when I was a kid, and we used to go there all the time. We had this teacher, Miss Egeltinger, that took us there damn near every Saturday. Sometimes we looked at the animals, and sometimes we looked at the stuff the Indians had made in ancient times, pottery and straw baskets and all stuff like that. I get very happy when I think about it, even now. I remember after we looked at all the Indian stuff, usually we went to see some movie in this big auditorium, Columbus. They were always showing Columbus discovering America, having one hell of a time getting old Ferdinand and Isabella to lend him the dough to buy ships with, and then the sailors mutinying on him and all. Nobody gave too much of a damn about old Columbus, but you always had a lot of candy and gum and stuff with you, and the inside of that auditorium had such a nice smell. It always smelled like it was raining outside, even if it wasn't, and you were in the only nice, dry, cozy place in the world. I loved that damn museum. I remember you had to go through the Indian room to get to the auditorium. It was a long, long room, and you were only supposed to whisper. The teacher would go first, then the class. You'd be two rows of kids, and you'd have a partner. Most of the time, my partner was this girl named Gertrude Levine. She always wanted to hold your hand, and her hand was always sticky or sweaty or something. The floor was all stone, and if you had some marbles in your hand and you dropped them, they bounced like madmen all over the floor and made a hell of a racket, and the teacher would hold up the class and go back and see what the hell was going on. She never got sore, though, Miss Egeltinger. Then you'd pass by this long, long Indian war canoe, about as long as three goddamn Cadillacs in a row, with about 20 Indians in it, some of them paddling, some of them just standing around looking tough, and they all had war paint all over their faces. There was one very spooky guy in the back of the canoe, with a mask on. He was the witch doctor. He gave me the creeps, but I liked him anyway. Another thing, if you touched one of the paddles or anything while you were passing, one of the guards would say to you, "Don't touch anything, children," but he always said it in a nice voice, not like a goddamn cop or anything. Then you'd pass by this big glass case with Indians inside it, rubbing sticks together to make a fire, and a squaw weaving a blanket. The squaw that was weaving the blanket was sort of bending over, and you could see her bosom and all. We all used to sneak a good look at it, even the girls, because they were only little kids and they didn't have any more bosom than we did. Then, just before you went inside the auditorium, right near the doors, you passed this Eskimo. He was sitting over a hole in this icy lake, and he was fishing through it. He had about two fish right next to the hole that he'd already caught. Boy, that museum was full of glass cases. There were even more upstairs, with deer inside them drinking at water holes and birds flying south for the winter. The birds nearest you were all stuffed and hung up on wires, and the ones in back were just painted on the wall, but they all looked like they were really flying south, and if you bent your head down and sort of looked at them upside down, they looked in an even bigger hurry to fly south. The best thing, though, in that museum was that everything always stayed right where it was. Nobody'd move. You could go there 100,000 times, and that Eskimo would still be just finished catching those two fish. The birds would still be on their way south. The deers would still be drinking out of that water hole with their pretty antlers and their pretty skinny legs, and that squaw with the naked bosom would still be weaving that same blanket. Nobody'd be different. The only thing that would be different would be you. Not that you'd be so much older or anything. It wouldn't be that exactly. You'd just be different, that's all. You'd have an overcoat on this time, or the kid that was your partner in line the last time had got scarlet fever and you'd have a new partner. Or you'd have a substitute taking the class instead of Miss Egeltinger. Or you'd heard your mother and father having a terrific fight in the bathroom. Or you'd just passed by one of those puddles in the street with gasoline rainbows in them. I mean, you'd be different in some way. I can't explain what I mean. Even if I could, I'm not sure I'd feel like it. I took my old hunting hat out of my pocket while I walked and put it on. I knew I wouldn't meet anybody that knew me, and it was pretty damp out. I kept walking and walking, and I kept thinking about old Phoebe going to that museum on Saturdays the way I used to. I thought how she'd see the same stuff I used to see, and how she'd be different every time she saw it. It didn't exactly depress me to think about it, but it didn't make me feel gay as hell either. Certain things, they should stay the way they are. You ought to be able to stick them in one of those big glass cases and just leave them alone. I know that's impossible, but it's too bad anyway. Anyway, I kept thinking about all that while I walked. I passed by this playground and stopped and watched a couple of very tiny kids on a seesaw. One of them was sort of fat, and I put my hand on the skinny kid's end to sort of even up the weight, but you could tell they didn't want me around, so I let them alone. Then, a funny thing happened. When I got to the museum, all of a sudden, I wouldn't have gone inside for $1 million. It just didn't appeal to me. And here I'd walked through the whole goddamn park and looked forward to it and all. If Phoebe had been there, I probably would have, but she wasn't. So all I did, in front of the museum, was get a cab and go down to the Biltmore. I didn't feel much like going. I'd made that damn date with Sally, though. 17. I was way early when I got there, so I just sat down on one of those leather couches right near the clock in the lobby and watched the girls. A lot of schools were home for vacation already, and there were about 1 million girls sitting and standing around waiting for their dates to show up. Girls with their legs crossed, girls with their legs not crossed, girls with terrific legs, girls with lousy legs, girls that looked like swell girls that looked like they'd be bitches if you knew them. It was really nice sightseeing, if you know what I mean. In a way, it was sort of depressing, too, because you kept wondering what the hell would happen to all of them. When they got out of school and college, I mean. You figured most of them would probably marry dopey guys. Guys that always talk about how many miles they get to a gallon in their goddamn cars. Guys that get sore and childish as hell if you beat them at golf, or even just some stupid game like ping pong. Guys that are very mean. Guys that never read books, guys that are very boring. But I have to be careful about that. I mean about calling certain guys bores. I don't understand boring guys. I really don't. When I was at Elkton Hills, I roomed for about 2 months with this boy, Harris Macklin. He was very intelligent and all, but he was one of the biggest bores I ever met. He had one of these very raspy voices, and he never stopped talking practically. He never stopped talking, and what was awful was he never said anything you wanted to hear in the first place. But he could do one thing. The son of a bitch could whistle better than anybody I ever heard. He'd be making his bed or hanging up stuff in the closet. He was always hanging up stuff in the closet. It drove me crazy. And he'd be whistling while he did it, if he wasn't talking in this raspy voice. He could even whistle classical stuff, but most of the time he just whistled jazz. He could take something very jazzy, like Tin Roof Blues, and whistle it so nice and easy, right while he was hanging stuff up in the closet, that it could kill you. Naturally, I never told him I thought he was a terrific whistler. I mean, you don't just go up to somebody and say you're a terrific whistler. But I roomed with him for about 2 whole months, even though he bored me till I was half crazy, just because he was such a terrific whistler, the best I ever heard. So I don't know about bores. Maybe you shouldn't feel too sorry if you see some swell girl getting married to them. They don't hurt anybody, most of them. And maybe they're secretly all terrific whistlers or something. Who the hell knows? Not me. Finally, old Sally started coming up the stairs, and I started down to meet her. She looked terrific. She really did. She had on this black coat and sort of a black beret. She hardly ever wore a hat, but that beret looked nice. The funny part is, I felt like marrying her the minute I saw her. I'm crazy. I didn't even like her much, and yet all of a sudden, I felt like I was in love with her and wanted to marry her. I swear to God, I'm crazy. I admit it. "Holden," she said, "it's marvelous to see you. It's been ages." She had one of these very loud, embarrassing voices when you met her somewhere. She got away with it because she was so damn good-looking. But it always gave me a pain in the ass. "Swell to see you," I said. I meant it, too. "How are you, anyway?" "Absolutely marvelous. Am I late?" I told her no, but she was around 10 minutes late, as a matter of fact. I didn't give a damn, though. All that crap they have in cartoons and the Saturday Evening Post and all, showing guys on street corners looking sore as hell because their dates are late, That's bunk. If a girl looks swell when she meets you, who gives a damn if she's late? Nobody. We better hurry, I said. The show starts at 2:40. We started going down the stairs to where the taxis are. What are we going to see? She said.
I don't know. The Lunts. It's all I could get tickets for.
The Lunts? Oh, marvelous! I told you she'd go mad when she heard it was for the Lunts. We horsed around a little bit in the cab on the way over to the theater. At first she didn't want to because she had her lipstick on and all. But I was being seductive as hell, and she didn't have any alternative. Twice, when the goddamn cab stopped short in traffic, I damn near fell off the seat. Those damn drivers never even look where they're going. I swear they don't. Then, just to show you how crazy I am, when we were coming out of this big clinch, I told her I loved her and all. It was a lie, of course, but the thing is, I meant it when I said it. I'm crazy. I swear to God I am. Oh, darling, I love you, too, she said. Then, right in the same damn breath, she said, promise me you'll let your hair grow. Crew cuts are getting corny, and your hair's so lovely. Lovely, my ass. The show wasn't as bad as some I've seen. It was on the crappy side, though. It was about 500,000 years in the life of this one old couple. It starts out when they're young and all, and the girl's parents don't want her to marry the boy, but she marries him anyway. Then they keep getting older and older. The husband goes to war, and the wife has this brother that's a drunkard. I couldn't get very interested. I mean, I didn't care too much when anybody in the family died or anything. They were all just a bunch of actors. The husband and wife were a pretty nice old couple, very witty and all, but I couldn't get too interested in them. For one thing, they kept drinking tea or some goddamn thing all through the play. Every time you saw them, some butler was shoving some tea in front of them, or the wife was pouring it for somebody. And everybody kept coming in and going out all the time. You got dizzy watching people sit down and stand up. Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne were the old couple. They were very good, but I didn't like them much. They were different, though, I'll say that. They didn't act like people, and they didn't act like actors. It's hard to explain. They acted more like they knew they were celebrities and all. I mean, they were good, but they were too good. When one of them got finished making a speech, the other one said something very fast right after it. It was supposed to be like people really talking and interrupting each other and all. The trouble was, it was too much like people talking and interrupting each other. They acted a little bit the way old Ernie down in the village plays the piano. If you do something too good, then after a while, if you don't watch it, you start showing off. And then, you're not as good anymore. But anyway, they were the only ones in the show, the Lunts, I mean, that looked like they had any real brains. I have to admit it. At the end of the first act, we went out with all the other jerks for a cigarette. What a deal that was. You never saw so many phonies in all your life. Everybody smoking their ears off and talking about the play so that everybody could hear and know how sharp they were. Some dopey movie actor was standing near us having a cigarette. I don't know his name, but he always plays the part of a guy in a war movie that gets yellow before it's time to go over the top. He was with some gorgeous blonde, and the two of them were trying to be very blasé and all, like as if he didn't even know people were looking at him. Modest as hell. I got a big bang out of it. Old Sally didn't talk much, except to rave about the Lunts, because she was busy rubbering and being charming. Then all of a sudden, she saw some jerk she knew on the other side of the lobby, some guy in one of those very dark gray flannel suits and one of those checkered vests, strictly Ivy League, big deal. He was standing next to the wall, smoking himself to death and looking bored as hell. Old Sally kept saying, "I know that boy from somewhere." She always knew somebody, any place you took her, or thought she did. She kept saying that till I got bored as hell, and I said to her, "Why don't you go on over and give him a big soul kiss if you know him? He'll enjoy it." She got sore when I said that. Finally, though, the jerk noticed her and came over and said hello. You should have seen the way they said hello. You'd have thought they hadn't seen each other in 20 years. You'd have thought they'd taken baths in the same bathtub or something when they were little kids. Old buddy ruse. It was nauseating. The funny part was, they probably met each other just once at some phony party. Finally, when they were all done slobbering around, old Sally introduced us. His name was George something, I don't even remember, and he went to Andover. Big, big deal. You should have seen him when old Sally asked him how he liked the play. He was the kind of a phony that have to give themselves room when they answer somebody's question. He stepped back and stepped right on the lady's foot behind her. He probably broke every toe in her body. He said the play itself was no masterpiece, but that the Lunts, of course, were absolute angels. Angels, for Christ's sake, angels. That killed me. Then he and old Sally started talking about a lot of people they both knew. It was the phoniest conversation you ever heard in your life. They both kept thinking of places as fast as they could. Then they'd think of somebody that lived there and mention their name. I was all set to puke when it was time to go sit down again. It really was. And then, when the next act was over, they continued their goddamn boring conversation. They kept thinking of more places and more names of people that lived there. The worst part was, the jerk had one of those very phony Ivy League voices, one of those very tired, snobby voices. He sounded just like a girl. He didn't hesitate to horn in on my date, the bastard. I even thought for a minute that he was going to get in the goddamn cab with us when the show was over, because he walked about 2 blocks with us, but he had to meet a bunch of phonies for cocktails, he said. I could see them all sitting around in some bar with their goddamn checkered vests, criticizing shows and books and women in those tired, snobby voices. They kill me, those guys. And I sort of hated old Sally by the time we got in the cab, after listening to that phony Andover bastard for about 10 hours. I was all set to take her home and all, I really was, but she said, "I have a marvelous idea." She was always having a marvelous idea. "Listen," she said, "what time do you have to be home for dinner? I mean, are you in a terrible hurry or anything? Do you have to be home any special time?" "Me? No, no special time," I said. Truer word was never spoken, boy. "Why?" "Let's go ice skating at Radio City." That's the kind of ideas she always had. "Ice skating at Radio City? You mean right now?" "Just for an hour or so. Don't you want to?" "If you don't want to..." "I didn't say I didn't want to," I said. "Sure, if you want to." "Do you mean it? Don't just say it if you don't mean it. I mean, I don't give a darn, one way or the other." Not much, she didn't. "You can rent those darling little skating skirts," old Sally said. "Jeanette Kultz did it last week." That's why she was so hot to go. She wanted to see herself in one of those little skirts that just come down over their butt and all. So we went, and after they gave us our skates, they gave Sally this little blue butt-twitcher of a dress to wear. She really did look damn good in it, though, I have to admit it. And don't think she didn't know it. She kept walking ahead of me, so that I'd see how cute her little ass looked. It did look pretty cute, too, I have to admit it. The funny part was, though, we were the worst skaters on the whole goddamn rink. I mean, the worst. And there were some Lulus, too. Old Sally's ankles kept bending in till they were practically on the ice. They not only looked stupid as hell, but they probably hurt like hell, too. I know mine did. Mine were killing me. We must have looked gorgeous. And what made it worse, there were at least a couple of 100 rubbernecks that didn't have anything better to do than stand around and watch everybody falling all over themselves. "Do you want to get a table inside and have a drink or something?" I said to her finally. "That's the most marvelous idea you've had all day," she said. She was killing herself. It was brutal. I really felt sorry for her. We took off our goddamn skates and went inside this bar where you can get drinks and watch the skaters in just your stocking feet. As soon as we sat down, old Sally took off her gloves and I gave her a cigarette. She wasn't looking too happy. The waiter came up, and I ordered a Coke for her, she didn't drink, and a scotch and soda for myself. But the son of a bitch wouldn't bring me one, so I had a Coke, too. Then I sort of started lighting matches. I do that quite a lot when I'm in a certain mood. I sort of let them burn down till I can't hold them anymore, then I drop them in the ashtray. It's a nervous habit. Then
All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, old Sally said, "Look, I have to know. Are you or aren't you coming over to help me trim the tree Christmas Eve? I have to know." She was still being snotty on account of her ankles when she was skating. "I wrote you I would. You've asked me that about 20 times. Sure I am." "I mean, I have to know," she said. She started looking all around the goddamn room. All of a sudden, I quit lighting matches and sort of leaned nearer to her over the table. I had quite a few topics on my mind. "Hey, Sally," I said.
"What?"
she said. She was looking at some girl on the other side of the room. "Did you ever get fed up?" I said. "I mean, did you ever get scared that everything was going to go lousy unless you did something? I mean, do you like school and all that stuff?"
"It's a terrific bore."
"I mean, do you hate it? I know it's a terrific bore, but do you hate it is what I mean."
"Well, I don't exactly hate it. You always have to..."
"Well, I hate it. Boy, do I hate it," I said. "But it isn't just that, it's everything. I hate living in New York and all. Taxi cabs, Madison Avenue buses with the drivers and all always yelling at you to get out at the rear door, and being introduced to phony guys that call the Lunds angels, and going up and down in elevators when you just want to go outside, and guys fitting your pants all the time at Brooks, and people always..." "Don't shout, please," old Sally said, which was very funny because I wasn't even shouting. "Take cars," I said. I said it in this very quiet voice. "Take most people. They're crazy about cars. They worry if they get a little scratch on them, and they're always talking about how many miles they get to a gallon, and if they get a brand new car already, they start thinking about trading it in for one that's even newer. I don't even like old cars. I mean, they don't even interest me. I'd rather have a goddamn horse. A horse is at least human, for God's sake. A horse, you can at least..."
"I don't know what you're even talking about," old Sally said.
"You jump from what..."
"You know something," I said. "You're probably the only reason I'm in New York right now, or anywhere. If you weren't around, I'd probably be someplace way the hell off, in the woods or some goddamn place. You're the only reason I'm around, practically."
"You're sweet," she said. But you could tell she wanted me to change the damn subject. "You ought to go to a boys' school sometime. Try it sometime," I said. "It's full of phonies, and all you do is study so that you can learn enough to be smart enough to be able to buy a goddamn Cadillac someday, and you have to keep making believe you give a damn if the football team loses, and all you do is talk about girls and liquor and sex all day, and everybody sticks together in these dirty little goddamn cliques. The guys that are on the basketball team stick together, the Catholics stick together, the goddamn intellectuals stick together, the guys that play bridge stick together. Even the guys that belong to the goddamn Book of the Month Club stick together. If you try to have a little intelligent..."
"Now listen," old Sally said. "Lots of boys get more out of school than that."
"I agree. I agree they do, some of them. But that's all I get out of it, see? That's my point. That's exactly my goddamn point," I said. "I don't get hardly anything out of anything. I'm in bad shape. I'm in lousy shape."
"You certainly are."
Then, all of a sudden, I got this idea. "Look," I said, "here's my idea. How would you like to get the hell out of here? Here's my idea. I know this guy down in Greenwich Village that we can borrow his car for a couple of weeks. He used to go to the same school I did, and he still owes me $10. What we could do is, tomorrow morning, we could drive up to Massachusetts and Vermont and all around there, see? It's beautiful as hell up there. It really is." I was getting excited as hell the more I thought about it, and I sort of reached over and took old Sally's goddamn hand. What a goddamn fool I was. "No kidding," I said. "I have about $180 in the bank. I can take it out when it opens in the morning, and then I could go down and get this guy's car. No kidding. We'll stay in these cabin camps and stuff like that till the dough runs out. Then when the dough runs out, I could get a job somewhere, and we could live somewhere with a brook and all, and later on we could get married or something. I could chop all our own wood in the winter time and all. Honest to God, we could have a terrific time. What do you say? Come on, what do you say? Will you do it with me? Please?"
"You can't just do something like that," old Sally said.
She sounded sore as hell.
Why not? Why the hell not?
Stop screaming at me, please, she said, which was crap because I wasn't even screaming at her. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.
Side 4. The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. Continuing on page 172.
Why can't you? Why not? Because you can't, that's all. In the first place, we're both practically children. And did you ever stop to think what you'd do if you didn't get a job when your money ran out? We'd starve to death. The whole thing's so fantastic. It isn't fantastic. I'd get a job. Don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about that. What's the matter? Don't you want to go with me? Say so if you don't. It isn't that. It isn't that at all, old Sally said. I was beginning to hate her in a way. We'll have oodles of time to do those things, all those things. I mean, after you go to college and all, and if we should get married and all, there'll be oodles of marvelous places to go to. You're just... No, there wouldn't be. There wouldn't be oodles of places to go to at all. It'd be entirely different, I said. Salinger, continuing on page 170. Side 4, The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger, continuing on page 172. Why can't you? Why not? Because you can't, that's all. In the first place, we're both practically children. And did you ever stop to think what you'd do if you didn't get a job when your money ran out? We'd starve to death. The whole thing's so fantastic, it isn't fantastic. I'd get a job. Don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about that. What's the matter? Don't you want to go with me? Say so if you don't. It isn't that. It isn't that at all, old Sally said. I was beginning to hate her in a way. We'll have oodles of time to do those things, all those things. I mean, after you go to college and all, and if we should get married and all, there'll be oodles of marvelous places to go to. You're just... No, there wouldn't be. There wouldn't be oodles of places to go to at all. It'd be entirely different, I said. I was getting depressed as hell again.
What? She said. I can't hear you. One minute you scream at me, and the next you...
I said, no, there wouldn't be marvelous places to go to after I went to college and all. Open your ears. It'd be entirely different. We'd have to go downstairs in elevators with suitcases and stuff. We'd have to phone up everybody and tell them goodbye and send them postcards from hotels and all. And I'd be working in some office, making a lot of dough, and riding to work in cabs and Madison Avenue buses, and reading newspapers, and playing bridge all the time, and going to the movies and seeing a lot of stupid shorts and coming attractions and newsreels. Newsreels, Christ almighty. There's always a dumb horse race and some Dane breaking a bottle over a ship and some chimpanzee riding a goddamn bicycle with pants on. It wouldn't be the same at all. You don't see what I mean at all.
Maybe I don't. Maybe you don't either, old Sally said.
We both hated each other's guts by that time. You could see there wasn't any sense trying to have an intelligent conversation. I was sorry as hell I'd started it.
Come on, let's get out of here, I said. You give me a royal pain in the ass if you want to know the truth.
Boy, did she hit the ceiling when I said that. I know I shouldn't have said it, and I probably wouldn't have ordinarily, but she was depressing the hell out of me. Usually I never say crude things like that to girls. Boy, did she hit the ceiling! I apologized like a madman, but she wouldn't accept my apology. She was even crying, which scared me a little bit, because I was a little afraid she'd go home and tell her father I called her a pain in the ass. Her father was one of those big silent bastards, and he wasn't too crazy about me anyhow. He once told old Sally I was too goddamn noisy.
No kidding. I'm sorry, I kept telling her.
You're sorry. You're sorry. That's very funny, she said.
She was still sort of crying, and all of a sudden I did feel sort of sorry I'd said it. Come on, I'll take you home, no kidding. I can go home by myself, thank you. If you think I'd let you take me home, you're mad. No boy ever said that to me in my entire life. The whole thing was sort of funny in a way, if you thought about it, and all of a sudden I did something I shouldn't have. I laughed. And I have one of these very loud, stupid laughs. I mean, if I ever sat behind myself in a movie or something, I'd probably lean over and tell myself to please shut up. It made old Sally madder than ever. I stuck around for a while, apologizing and trying to get her to excuse me, but she wouldn't. She kept telling me to go away and leave her alone. So finally I did it. I went inside and got my shoes and stuff and left without her. I shouldn't have, but I was pretty goddamn fed up by that time. If you want to know the truth, I don't even know why I started all that stuff with her. I mean about going away somewhere to Massachusetts and Vermont and all. I probably wouldn't have taken her even if she'd wanted to go with me. She wouldn't have been anybody to go with. The terrible part, though, is that I meant it when I asked her. That's the terrible part. I swear to God, I'm a madman. 18. When I left the skating rink, I felt sort of hungry, so I went in this drugstore and had a Swiss cheese sandwich and a malted, and then I went in the phone booth. I thought maybe I might give old Jane another buzz and see if she was home yet. I mean, I had the whole evening free, and I thought I'd give her a buzz, and if she was home yet, take her dancing or something somewhere. I never danced with her or anything the whole time I knew her. I saw her dancing once, though. She looked like a very good dancer. It was at this 4th of July dance at the club. I didn't know her too well then, and I didn't think I ought to cut in on her date. She was dating this terrible guy, Al Pike, that went to Choate. I didn't know him too well, but he was always hanging around the swimming pool. He wore those white Lastex kind of swimming trunks, and he was always going off the high dive. He did the same lousy old half-gainer all day long. It was the only dive he could do, but he thought he was very hot stuff, all muscles and no brains. Anyway, that's who Jane dated that night. I couldn't understand it. I swear I couldn't. After we started going around together, I asked her how come she could date a show-off bastard like Al Pike. Jane said he wasn't a show-off. She said he had an inferiority complex. She acted like she felt sorry for him or something. And she wasn't just putting it on. She meant it. It's a funny thing about girls. Every time you mention some guy that's strictly a bastard, very mean or very conceited and all, and when you mention it to the girl, she'll tell you he has an inferiority complex. Maybe he has, but that still doesn't keep him from being a bastard, in my opinion. Girls, you never know what they're going to think. I once got this girl, Roberta Walsh's roommate, a date with a friend of mine. His name was Bob Robinson, and he really had an inferiority complex. You could tell he was very ashamed of his parents and all, because they said he don't and she don't and stuff like that, and they weren't very wealthy. But he wasn't a bastard or anything. He was a very nice guy. But this Roberta Walsh's roommate didn't like him at all. She told Roberta he was too conceited, and the reason she thought he was conceited was because he happened to mention to her that he was captain of the debating team. A little thing like that, and she thought he was conceited. The trouble with girls is, if they like a boy, no matter how big a bastard he is, they'll say he has an inferiority complex, and if they don't like him, no matter how nice a guy he is or how big an inferiority complex he has, they'll say he's conceited. Even smart girls do it. Anyway, I gave old Jane a buzz again, but her phone didn't answer, so I had to hang up. Then I had to look through my address book to see who the hell might be available for the evening. The trouble was, though, my address book only has about 3 people in it. Jane, and this man, Mr. Antolini, that was my teacher at Elkton Hills, and my father's office number. I keep forgetting to put people's names in. So what I did finally, I gave old Carl Luce a buzz. He graduated from the Wooten School after I left. He was about 3 years older than I was, and I didn't like him too much, but he was one of these very intellectual guys. He had the highest IQ of any boy at Wooten, and I thought he might want to have dinner with me somewhere and have a slightly intellectual conversation. He was very enlightening sometimes. So I gave him a buzz. He went to Columbia now, but he lived on 65th Street and all, and I knew he'd be home. When I got him on the phone, he said he couldn't make it for dinner, but that he'd meet me for a drink at 10 o'clock at the Wicker Bar on 54th. I think he was pretty surprised to hear from me. I once called him a fat-assed phony. I had quite a bit of time to kill till 10 o'clock, so what I did, I went to the movies at Radio City. It was probably the worst thing I could have done, but it was near, and I couldn't think of anything else. I came in when the goddamn stage show was on. The Rockettes were kicking their heads off the way they do when they're all in line with their arms around each other's waist. The audience applauded like mad, and some guy behind me kept saying to his wife, "You know what that is? That's precision." He killed me. Then, after the Rockettes, a guy came out in a tuxedo and roller skates on and started skating under a bunch of little tables and telling jokes while he did it. He was a very good skater and all, but I couldn't enjoy it much because I kept picturing him practicing to be a guy that roller skates on the stage. It seemed so stupid. I guess I just wasn't in the right mood. Then, after him, they had this Christmas thing they have at Radio City every year. All these angels start coming out of the boxes and everywhere, guys carrying crucifixes and stuff all over the place, and a whole bunch of them, thousands of them, singing "Come All Ye Faithful," like mad. Big deal. It's supposed to be religious as hell, I know, and very pretty and all, but I can't see anything religious or pretty, for God's sake, about a bunch of actors carrying crucifixes all over the stage. When they were all finished and started going out the boxes again, you could tell they could hardly wait to get a cigarette or something. I saw it with old Sally Hayes the year before, and she kept saying how beautiful it was, the costumes and all. I said old Jesus probably would have puked if he could see it, all those fancy costumes and all. Sally said I was a sacrilegious atheist. I probably am. The thing Jesus really would have liked would be the guy that plays the kettle drums in the orchestra. I've watched that guy since I was about 8 years old. My brother Allie and I, if we were with our parents and all, we used to move our seats and go way down so we could watch him. He's the best drummer I ever saw. He only gets a chance to bang them a couple of times during a whole piece, but he never looks bored when he isn't doing it. Then, when he does bang them, he does it so nice and sweet with this nervous expression on his face. One time, when we went to Washington with my father, Allie sent him a postcard, but I'll bet he never got it. We weren't too sure how to address it. After the Christmas thing was over, the goddamn picture started. It was so putrid I couldn't take my eyes off it. It was about this English guy, Alex something, that was in the war and loses his memory in the hospital and all. He comes out of the hospital carrying a cane and limping all over the place, all over London, not knowing who the hell he is. He's really a duke, but he doesn't know it. Then he meets this nice, homey, sincere girl getting on a bus. Her goddamn hat blows off, and he catches it, and then they go upstairs and sit down and start talking about Charles Dickens. He's both their favorite author and all. He's carrying this copy of Oliver Twist, and so's she. I could have puked. Anyway, they fall in love right away, on account of they're both so nuts about Charles Dickens and all, and he helps her run her publishing business. She's a publisher, the girl. Only she's not doing so hot because her brother's a drunkard and he spends all their dough. He's a very bitter guy, the brother, because he was a doctor in the war, and now he can't operate anymore because his nerves are shot, so he boozes all the time, but he's pretty witty and all. Anyway, old Alec writes a book, and this girl publishes it, and they both make a hat full of dough on it. They're all set to get married when this other girl, old Marcia, shows up. Marcia was Alec's fiancée before he lost his memory, and she recognizes him when he's in this store autographing books. She tells old Alec he's really a duke and all, but he doesn't believe her and doesn't want to go with her to visit his mother and all. His mother's blind as a bat. But the other girl, the homie one, makes him go. She's very noble and all, so he goes. But he still doesn't get his memory back, even when his great Dane jumps all over him and his mother sticks her fingers all over his face and brings him this teddy bear he used to slobber around with when he was a kid. But then, one day, some kids are playing cricket on the lawn, and he gets smacked in the head with a cricket ball. Then, right away, he gets his goddamn memory back, and he goes in and kisses his mother on the forehead and all. Then he starts being a regular duke again, and he forgets all about the homey babe that has the publishing business. I'd tell you the rest of the story, but I might puke if I did. It isn't that I'd spoil it for you or anything. There isn't anything to spoil, for Christ's sake. Anyway, it ends up with Alec and the homie babe getting married, and the brother that's a drunkard gets his nerves back and operates on Alec's mother so she can see again, and then the drunken brother and old Marcia go for each other. It ends up with everybody at this long dinner table laughing their asses off because the Great Dane comes in with a bunch of puppies. Everybody thought it was a male, I suppose, or some goddamn thing. All I can say is, don't see it if you don't want to puke all over yourself. The part that got me was, there was a lady sitting next to me that cried all through the goddamn picture. The phonier it got, the more she cried. You'd have thought she did it because she was kind-hearted as hell, but I was sitting right next to her, and she wasn't. She had this little kid with her that was bored as hell and had to go to the bathroom, but she wouldn't take him. She kept telling him to sit still and behave himself. She was about as kind-hearted as a goddamn wolf. You take somebody that cries their goddamn eyes out over phony stuff in the movies, and 9 times out of 10 they're mean bastards at heart. I'm not kidding. After the movie was over, I started walking down to the Wicker Bar where I was supposed to meet old Carl Luce, and while I walked, I sort of thought about war and all. Those war movies always do that to me. I don't think I could stand it if I had to go to war. I really couldn't. It wouldn't be too bad if they'd just take you out and shoot you or something. But you have to stay in the army so goddamn long. That's the whole trouble. My brother D.B. was in the army for 4 goddamn years. He was in the war, too. He landed on D-Day and all. But I really think he hated the army worse than the war. I was practically a child at the time, but I remember when he used to come home on furlough and all he did was lie on his bed, practically. He hardly ever even came in the living room. Later, when he went overseas and was in the war and all, he didn't get wounded or anything, and he didn't have to shoot anybody. All he had to do was drive some cowboy general around all day in a command car. He once told Allie and I that if he'd had to shoot anybody, he wouldn't have known which direction to shoot in. He said the army was practically as full of bastards as the Nazis were. I remember Allie once asked him, wasn't it sort of good that he was in the war because he was a writer and it gave him a lot to write about and all? He made Allie go get his baseball mitt, and then he asked him who was the best war poet, Rupert Brooke or Emily Dickinson. Allie said Emily Dickinson. I don't know too much about it myself because I don't read much poetry, but I do know it'd drive me crazy if I had to be in the army and be with a bunch of guys like Ackley and Stradlater and old Maurice all the time, marching with them and all. I was in the Boy Scouts once for about a week, and I couldn't even stand looking at the back of the guy's neck in front of me. They kept telling you to look at the back of the guy's neck in front of you. And I swear, if there's ever another war, they better just take me out and stick me in front of a firing squad. I wouldn't object. What gets me about D.B., though, he hated the war so much, and yet he got me to read this book, A Farewell to Arms, last summer. He said it was so terrific. That's what I can't understand. It had this guy in it named Lieutenant Henry that was supposed to be a nice guy and all. I don't see how D.B. could hate the army and war and all so much and still like a phony like that. I mean, for instance, I don't see how he could like a phony book like that and still like that one by Ring Lardner, or that other one he's so crazy about, The Great Gatsby. D.B. got sore when I said that, and said I was too young and all to appreciate it, but I don't think so. I told him I liked Ring Lardner and The Great Gatsby and all. I did, too. I was crazy about The Great Gatsby. Old Gatsby, old sport, that killed me. Anyway, I'm sort of glad they've got the atomic bomb invented. If there's ever another war, I'm going to sit right the hell on top of it. I'll volunteer for it. I swear to God I will. 19. In case you don't live in New York, the Wicker Bar is in this sort of swanky hotel, the Seton Hotel. I used to go there quite a lot, but I don't anymore. I gradually cut it out. It's one of those places that is supposed to be very sophisticated and all, and the phonies are coming in the window. They used to have these 2 French babes, Tina and Janine, come out and play the piano and sing about 3 times every night. One of them played the piano, strictly lousy, and the other one sang, and most of the songs were either pretty dirty or in French. The one that sang, old Janine, was always whispering into the goddamn microphone before she sang. She'd say, "And now we'd like to give you our impression of Voulez-vous Francais.
It is the story of a little French girl who comes to a big city just like New York and falls in love with a little boy from Brooklyn. We hope you like it.
Then, when she was all done whispering and being cute as hell, she'd sing some dopey song, half in English and half in French, and drive all the phonies in the place mad with joy. If you sat around there long enough and heard all the phonies applauding and all, you got to hate everybody in the world, I swear you did. The bartender was a louse, too. He was a big snob. He didn't talk to you at all, hardly, unless you were a big shot or a celebrity or something. If you were a big shot or a celebrity or something, then he was even more nauseating. He'd go up to you and say, with this big charming smile, like he was a hell of a swell guy if you knew him, "Well, how's Connecticut?" or "How's Florida?" It was a terrible place, I'm not kidding. I cut out going there entirely, gradually. It was pretty early when I got there. I sat down at the bar, it was pretty crowded, and had a couple of scotch and sodas before old Luce even showed up. I stood up when I ordered them so they could see how tall I was and all and not think I was a goddamn miner. Then I watched the phonies for a while. Some guy next to me was snowing hell out of the baby he was with. He kept telling her she had aristocratic hands. That killed me. The other end of the bar was full of flits. They weren't too flitty-looking. I mean, they didn't have their hair too long or anything, but you could tell they were flits anyway. Finally, old Luce showed up. Old Luce. What a guy. He was supposed to be my student advisor when I was at Wooten. The only thing he ever did, though, was give these sex talks and all, late at night, when there was a bunch of guys in his room. He knew quite a bit about sex, especially perverts and all. He was always telling us about a lot of creepy guys that go around having affairs with sheep, and guys that go around with girls' pants sewed in the lining of their hats and all, and flits and lesbians. Old Luce knew who every flit and lesbian in the United States was. All you had to do was mention somebody, anybody, and old Luce'd tell you if he was a flit or not. Sometimes it was hard to believe the people he said were flits and lesbians and all, movie actors and like that. Some of the ones he said were flits were even married, for God's sake. You keep saying to him, "You mean Joe Blow's a flit? Joe Blow? That big tough guy that plays gangsters and cowboys all the time?" Old Luce would say, "Certainly." He was always saying, "Certainly." He said it didn't matter if a guy was married or not. He said half the married guys in the world were flits and didn't even know it. He said you could turn into one practically overnight, if you had all the traits and all. He used to scare the hell out of us. I kept waiting to turn into a flit or something. The funny thing about old Luce, I used to think he was sort of flitty himself in a way. He was always saying, "Try this for size," and then he'd goose the hell out of you while you were going down the corridor. And whenever he went to the can, he always left the goddamn door open and talked to you while you were brushing your teeth or something. That stuff's sort of flitty, it really is. I've known quite a few real flits at schools and all, and they're always doing stuff like that. And that's why I always had my doubts about old Luce. He was a pretty intelligent guy, though. He really was. He never said hello or anything when he met you. The first thing he said when he sat down was that he could only stay a couple of minutes. He said he had a date. Then he ordered a dry martini. He told the bartender to make it very dry and no olive. "Hey, I got a flit for you," I told him, "at the end of the bar. Don't look now. I've been saving him for you." "Very funny," he said. "Same old Caulfield. When are you going to grow up?" I bored him a lot. I really did. He amused me, though. He was one of those guys that sort of amused me a lot. "How's your sex life?" I asked him. He hated you to ask him stuff like that. "Relax," he said. "Just sit back and relax, for Christ's sake." "I'm relaxed," I said. "How's Columbia? You like it?"
"Certainly I like it. If I didn't like it, I wouldn't have gone there," he said. He could be pretty boring himself sometimes.
"What are you majoring in?" I asked him. "Perverts?"
I was only horsing around.
"What are you trying to be? Funny?"
"No, I'm only kidding," I said.
"Listen, hey, Luce, you're one of these intellectual guys. I need your advice. I'm in a terrific..." He let out this big groan on me.
"Listen, Caulfield, if you want to sit here and have a quiet, peaceful drink and a quiet, peaceful convert.
All right, I said. Relax.
You could tell he didn't feel like discussing anything serious with me. That's the trouble with these intellectual guys. They never want to discuss anything serious unless they feel like it. So all I did was I started discussing topics in general with him.
No kidding, how's your sex life? I asked him.
You still going around with that same babe you used to at Wooten, the one with the terrific...
Good God, no, he said.
How come? What happened to her?
I haven't the faintest idea. For all I know, since you ask, she's probably the whore of New Hampshire by this time.
That isn't nice. If she was decent enough to let you get sexy with her all the time, you at least shouldn't talk about her that way.
Oh, God, old Luce said. Is this going to be a typical Caulfield conversation? I want to know right now.
No, I said, but it isn't nice anyway. If she was decent and nice enough to let you...
Must we pursue this horrible trend of thought? I didn't say anything. I was sort of afraid he'd get up and leave on me if I didn't shut up. So all I did was I ordered another drink. I felt like getting stinking drunk.
Who are you going around with now? I asked him.
You feel like telling me?
Nobody you know.
Yeah, but who? I might know her.
Girl lives in the village. Sculptress, if you must know.
Yeah, no kidding. How old is she?
I've never asked her, for God's sake.
Well, around how old?
I should imagine she's in her late 30s, old Luce said.
In her late 30s? Yeah? You like that? I asked him. You like him that old?
The reason I was asking was because he really knew quite a bit about sex and all. He was one of the few guys I knew that did. He lost his virginity when he was only 14 in Nantucket. He really did.
I like a mature person, if that's what you mean. Certainly.
You do? Why? No kidding. They better for sex and all?
Listen, let's get one thing straight. I refuse to answer any typical Caulfield questions tonight. When in hell are you going to grow up?
I didn't say anything for a while. I let it drop for a while. Then old Luce ordered another martini and told the bartender to make it a lot drier.
Listen, how long have you been going around with her, this sculpture babe? I asked him. I was really interested.
Did you know her when you were at Wooten?
Hardly. She just arrived in this country a few months ago.
She did? Where's she from?
She happens to be from Shanghai.
No kidding. She Chinese, for Christ's sake?
Obviously.
No kidding. Do you like that, her being Chinese?
Obviously.
Why? I'd be interested to know. I really would.
I simply happen to find Eastern philosophy more satisfactory than Western, since you ask.
You do? What do you mean, philosophy? You mean sex and all? You mean it's better in China? Is that what you mean?
Not necessarily in China, for God's sake. The East, I said. Must we go on with this inane conversation?
Listen, I'm serious, I said. No kidding. Why is it better in the East?
It's too involved to go into, for God's sake, old Luce said. They simply happen to regard sex as both a physical and a spiritual experience.
If you think I'm...
So do I. So do I regard it as a, what do you call it, a physical and spiritual experience and all. I really do. But it depends on who the hell I'm doing it with. If I'm doing it with somebody I don't even...
Not so loud, for God's sake, Caulfield. If you can't manage to keep your voice down, let's drop the whole...
All right, but listen, I said. I was getting excited, and I was talking a little too loud. Sometimes I talk a little loud when I get excited.
This is what I mean, though, I said. I know it's supposed to be physical and spiritual and artistic and all, but what I mean is you can't do it with everybody, every girl you neck with and all, and make it come out that way. Can you?
Let's drop it, old Luce said. Do you mind?
All right, but listen, take you and this Chinese babe. What's so good about you two?
Drop it, I said. I was getting a little too personal, I realized that. But that was one of the annoying things about Luce. When we were at Wooten, he'd make you describe the most personal stuff that happened to you,
but if you started asking him questions about himself, he got sore. These intellectual guys don't like to have an intellectual conversation with you unless they're running the whole thing. They always want you to shut up when they shut up, and go back to your room when they go back to their room. When I was at Wooten, old Luce used to hate it, you really could tell he did, when after he was finished giving this sex talk to a bunch of us in his room, we stuck around and chewed the fat by ourselves for a while. I mean the other guys and myself, in somebody else's room. Old Luce hated that. He always wanted everybody to go back to their own room and shut up when he was finished being the big shot. The thing he was afraid of, he was afraid somebody'd say something smarter than he had. He really amused me. "Maybe I'll go to China. My sex life is lousy," I said.
"Naturally, your mind is immature."
"It is. It really is. I know it," I said. "You know what the trouble with me is? I can never get really sexy, I mean really sexy, with a girl I don't like a lot. I mean, I have to like her a lot. If I don't, I sort of lose my goddamn desire for her and all. Boy, it really screws up my sex life something awful. My sex life stinks."
"Naturally it does, for God's sake. I told you the last time I saw you what you need."
"You mean to go to a psychoanalyst and all?" I said. "That's what he told me I ought to do. His father was a psychoanalyst and all."
"It's up to you, for God's sake. It's none of my goddamn business what you do with your life."
I didn't say anything for a while. I was thinking. "Supposing I went to your father and had him psychoanalyze me and all," I said. "What would he do to me? I mean, what would he do to me?"
"He wouldn't do a goddamn thing to you. He'd simply talk to you, and you'd talk to him, for God's sake. For one thing, he'd help you to recognize the patterns of your mind."
"The what?"
"The patterns of your mind. Your mind runs in..." "Listen, I'm not giving an elementary course in psychoanalysis. If you're interested, call him up and make an appointment. If you're not, don't. I couldn't care less, frankly." I put my hand on his shoulder. Boy, he amused me.
"You're a real friendly bastard," I told him. "You know that?"
He was looking at his wristwatch. "I have to tear," he said, and stood up. "Nice seeing you." He got the bartender and told him to bring him his check.
"Hey," I said, just before he beat it, "did your father ever psychoanalyze you?"
"Me? Why do you ask?"
"No reason. Did he, though? Has he?"
"Not exactly. He's helped me to adjust myself to a certain extent, but an extensive analysis hasn't been necessary. Why do you ask?"
"No reason. I was just wondering."
"Well, take it easy," he said. He was leaving his tip and all, and he was starting to go.
"Have just one more drink," I told him. "Please. I'm lonesome as hell. No kidding."
He said he couldn't do it, though. He said he was late now, and then he left. Old Luce. He was strictly a pain in the ass, but he certainly had a good vocabulary. He had the largest vocabulary of any boy at Wooten when I was there. They gave us a test.
20. I kept sitting there getting drunk and waiting for old Tina and Janine to come out and do their stuff, but they weren't there. A flitty-looking guy with wavy hair came out and played the piano, and then this new babe, Valencia, came out and sang. She wasn't any good, but she was better than old Tina and Janine, and at least she sang good songs. The piano was right next to the bar where I was sitting and all, and old Valencia was standing practically right next to me. I sort of gave her the old eye, but she pretended she didn't even see me. I probably wouldn't have done it, but I was getting drunk as hell. When she was finished, she beat it out of the room so fast I didn't even get a chance to invite her to join me for a drink, so I called the head waiter over. I told him to ask old Valencia if she'd care to join me for a drink. He said he would, but he probably didn't even give her my message. People never give you a message to anybody. Boy, I sat at that goddamn bar till around 1 o'clock or so, getting drunk as a bastard. I could hardly see straight. The one thing I did, though, I was careful as hell not to get boisterous or anything. I didn't want anybody to notice me or anything or ask how old I was. But, boy, I could hardly see straight. When I was really drunk, I started that stupid business with a bullet in my guts again. I was the only guy at the bar with a bullet in their guts. I kept putting my hand under my jacket, on my stomach and all, to keep the blood from dripping all over the place. I didn't want anybody to know I was even wounded. I was concealing the fact that I was a wounded son of a bitch. Finally, what I felt like giving old Jane a buzz and see if she was home yet. So I paid my check.